UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. My name is Agla, and I'm the host of UEG Talks, educational and hopefully fun dive into GI world and beyond. We're happy to have you with us for another exciting episode. So today we're talking all things dark and twisted, the scenarios that we find occasionally ourselves in, being on a brink, at our wits, grasping at the straws. And to dwell into this dark scenario, it is my utmost pleasure to do that with a spitful of energy and kindness, ever so supportive chair of National Societies Forum, driving force for physician well-being within UEG, Professor Martina Müller-Schiller. Welcome to UEG Talks, Martina.
I'm so happy to be here. It's just great to be with you today.
And we're very happy to talk to you about this important topic that's very serious and dark, but we will find some light with us together. Okay?
Okay.
This episode actually came with us both reading the same article in The Guardian that was titled U.S. Surgeons Are Killing Themselves at an Alarming Rate. One decided to speak out. And that article showcased Carrie Cunningham, president of Association of Academic Surgery, who spoke out loudly at a conference about her struggles, depression, and substance abuse. It shocked the society. But why is it still shocking to speak out personally about our experience when the data is there to support it? We are 30 to 100 times more likely to abuse substance. So why is it speaking out still such a shock?
So why the data on burnout is here and mental health issues and suicide data exist, changing deeply held cultural norms and behaviors takes much longer. So the data is there, but it needs a culture change. And there's a disconnect in my eyes between what the data show us and the readiness of the medical community and society at large to openly address these issues without judgment. And I think this is why Carrie Cunningham spoke up. And when she was later interviewed, she received standing ovations, and it was an historic opening speech. Later on, she said, "I did it because I wanted to initiate a change in the conversation and the culture." And I think this is important, and this leads us to the false dichotomy of resilience and vulnerability. I think there is a mistaken belief that resilience is incompatible with vulnerability. The data that you are referring to, Agla, data shows physicians have higher resilience scores compared to the general population. Yet they still experience high rates of burnout. Physicians with the highest resilience scores, a perfect age, still showed a 30% burnout rate. And this is, in my eyes, clear evidence that occupational burnout is a systems issue originating from problems in the work environment rather than a weakness in the worker.
Okay. Could I double down on the darkness of the topic regarding the dichotomy of personal stories versus the data? So maybe there's a reason that we so empathetically react to those personal stories versus just numbers.
This is absolutely true, Agla. And that is why we need people like Carrie Cunningham speaking up, because the data have been out there for a long time. The tools have been out there for a long time, and the research has been out there. And I think still it needs the courage of an individual to speak out so that we really can identify and we really understand there's a leader in surgery speaking out. And I think what is most important is that we need to remember that well-being issues do not just touch us. They touch our patients. They affect doctors who work with us. our co-workers, the whole healthcare team, and the work climate. And this is why it's important to consider the data. It's important to think about how is my own work environment? What can I do to really come to a cultural and communication change?
So, Martinette, touching up on something that you already mentioned, that we fear of speaking out. And there might be many reasons. We fear the judgment of the colleagues, losing future opportunities, being perceived as weak. What can we do to change it as a very intimate society where everybody knows each other?
I think we have to take a look at the data. These are research data. And the data, as you said, they are out. The tools are there. The research is there. There's also the possibility for change. How can we induce change? This has always been a clear challenge. But we need to remember that well-being issues do not just touch on ourselves. They touch on our patients. They affect doctors who are working with us. They affect our co-workers, the whole healthcare team, and our work climate. You know, I'd like my co-workers to come to work every morning and be just the best of themselves, him or herself. That is important for me. And we do not necessarily need brand new ways of fixing these problems, but we do need to recognize that they come from how the healthcare system is organized. And I think that is a key issue, putting the pressure not on the individual. Don't turf the responsibility on the individual. It's a system that should be fixed, and I'm sure we can elaborate on interventions that are appropriate. And this is, I think, a major point that I'd like to convey. It's the system that needs to change. And this is why I'd encourage to speak up. This is why I'd encourage to seek networks. This is why I'd like to encourage you to co-work together so that we create safe working and learning environments.
Okay, I get your point. The change should be systematic, but it's also a grassroots moment where we have to speak out for the problem to be evident, for there to be a change.
Right, because we are aware. And now we just have to undertake steps from awareness to the solution and from awareness to change.
Okay, I get your point. But now, coming from a spoiled millennial, I have a very personal question. It is not rare that taking a leave of absence or time off, questioning overtime of quite unreasonable workload, result in remarks as, "It was not like that in my time," by our senior colleagues. "If I suffered, you have to suffer too. It's a rite of passage." And examining status quo may open a can of all these millennials and their emotions. So my question is, how much is the problem perpetuated by a generational clash?
We have to take a look at the data again. Off note, physicians under the age of 35 have been shown to be at greater risk for burnout. A study from the American Medical Association with more than 7,000 participants concluded that 37% of gastroenterologists reported burnout. And in addition, it clearly showed that younger professionals are the most affected. The increased prevalence of burnout amongst trainees and early career gastroenterologists is yet another reason why addressing the issue is critical for the gastroenterological community, for us, and the medical community as a whole. So data suggests that young GIs are more prone to perceiving a sense of lack of personal achievement, one of the key causes of burnout. And another key cause may be that they have less autonomy. Furthermore, physicians in specialities at the front line of care seem to be at greater risks. Also, female physicians may have a higher risk of burnout, often related to work-home conflicts. Thus, again, is clearly pointing and highlighting at the systemic nature of the problems. And when senior colleagues attribute concerns about burnout to individual factors or generational traits, they may overlook or underprioritize the need for systemic solutions. And that, I promise you, can benefit all physicians, regardless of age.
So is your solution to this, these comments, like, you should suffer as I did suffer? Should we be giving the data to the senior colleagues who mumble about it?
I am actually very proud to be a physician. It's the greatest privilege. In addition to being a mother and a wife. So it's the greatest privilege, and I'd like to share the privilege. And I'd like to share the fun I have and the fulfillment I have with my profession. And we all must recognize that clinicians are valuable and they must be recognized as such. And this is what I would answer. Clinicians are valuable. They must be recognized as such. It is insufficient to focus solely on recruitment. We must adopt long-term strategies and focus on retention by investing in and supporting employees. If I may, Egle, I would like to reflect on the history of research on well-being. And because then we may understand why our senior colleagues, they say, you know, we have suffered, and actually we have suffered. We are all coming from an era where there were no regulations of the workload, no regulations of working hours. And I'd like to recommend a review of Tate Hennefeld. He is a Stanford hematologist, and of note, he is the chief wellness officer of Stanford Medicine since 2017. And he has really, really written a very good overview about the history of research of well-being. And he said there are three historical eras. One historical era, this is the one of the senior colleagues, and it lasted maybe until 2005. And he called it the era of distress. So I suffered, you maybe should suffer a little bit too. Please, no, we do not want to be back in the early 2000s. We don't want to go back to the era of distress. How was the field before 2005? I can tell you exactly. During this time, our professional culture, the culture of medicine, was characterized by a mindset of perfectionism that reinforced the concept of physicians, and I call that as deity. We have the German word of a Halbgott in weiss. And this framework had no place for vulnerability, of course. And we were not encouraged to speak out. This is why I encourage everybody to speak out now. But because, you know, the mindset was never let them see you sweat. Never, ever. So collectively, all these factors contributed to a physician's professional identity that just, I think, neglected their human identity. There were no limits on work. And the concept that there were boundaries between personal and professional life was maybe, as you suggested, regarded as a lack of commitment. That was, of course, not true. But this was how this era of distress, and this is Hennefeld's term, and I think it describes this era, this was how it went. We have to change that, because over time, there's increasing evidence and research that really challenges these historical paradigms. So let's take a look at our situation today. We have data that really, really prove that there is research and that we have all the tools that we need to initiate change. We need to change the system because many of our co-workers, they are leaving the system. This is not a sustainable future for healthcare. So the present, I think, can found and find support in that the World Health Organization has codified burnout as an occupational syndrome. We have now harmonized definitions for burnout established. We don't want to just prevent burnout, as I said. We are achieving, striving for well-being. And therefore, we have instruments to assess the syndrome. And this is, I think, the direction we should go. And so far, we are always focusing on patient needs. And I think that is important. But it's also important to focus on people's needs who work in the healthcare system. And I think this would be the future, actually. It would be a mindset that cultivates well-being and prevents occupational distress. And this is much more than simply reducing burnout. This is a work environment where you can really thrive, where you can learn, and where you do not have to think, is something wrong with me when I do exert self-care? And I think this is a very important task for the leadership and for the organization. We have suffered, but we should do anything to prevent our fellow colleagues from suffering.
Marjana, this is coming to your introduction. You're way too kind, and not everyone is so. No. Okay, you talked extensively about what can we do about in our own enclosed society. But I was wondering, how much is it a problem of our own medical society and with its own rules of existence, our ways, and how much does societal pressure contribute to it? To take responsibility for another human being's life is, we have to appear supernormal, never sick, never at a loss, never failing. And I was wondering, how much does the pressure from public contribute to our problems?
I think you are quite right. There's challenge and there's also a great responsibility. But I really think we have to stress that we are in a privileged profession. And this is what we should convey. It's always easy to put the blame on the public, but we should not forget that's upon us to change the system and that's upon us to speak out. It's also on us to make quite clear that we are striving for a medical future that values all persons in the healthcare system. So this is, I think, the way of addressing this, to strive for, let's say, a new mindset where we acknowledge that we'd like to enable people to meet all the options they have in life. And an organizational shift from patient needs to a people focus that attends to the needs of all individuals working together in clinical practice. And this, at the end, I think, will provide the best patient care.
Because a burnout physician is of no use to the patient, right? It can be that pragmatic, just weird that we are not talking about that. If you lose a doctor, a physician to a burnout, you're one doctor short, basically.
Right. There is an enormous consequence of burnout, and we have to really address, and we cannot underline this enough. The consequence is higher turnover rates, reduced clinical productivity. It's a reduction in quality of patient care. It's a loss of budget. So there is such a huge disadvantage and such huge consequences. Also like medical errors or impaired professionalism. And of course, in such a system, patient satisfaction will soon be reduced. So again, this encourages to create a culture of open discussion.
Okay, I get this is very logical. This should be done, this and that, and the society should understand this, and our bosses should understand this. Still, I feel so guilty, and I feel the blame in my patient's eyes when I leave my endoscopy suit to go to the bathroom. I feel judged taking care about myself.
I can absolutely agree. It is a very new philosophy for that I'm just putting forward for myself also, putting not the patient first. So that has never come actually into my mind. And this is why it's so new to me. It's such a new philosophy. But I think if we feel good, everybody else will notice that. So, but we have to really initiate profound changes. And as you said, we have to take care of the younger professionals because, as you said, they start feeling guilty. And that's not the mindset that we'd like to convey. You don't have to be a hero as a physician. You just have to be a human, a good human being.
Oh, that's so heartwarming. Martin, I was wondering, you talked a lot of data about societal pressures, about the systematic changes. You're the boss. What are the good ways in your department that you implement to deal with all the suffering in our work?
Actually, we have thought about this quite a lot. And we have implemented some projects, some strategies, and we have evaluated these projects because we wanted to know where do we stand as a clinical department? How do our employees feel? And this is why we were talking about how we can initiate change in our department. And the first thing that turned out, and we have published this year, was that interprofessional approaches and teamwork is a good foundation to work together. So we have set our focus on interprofessional approaches, and we have established two interprofessional student boards. And that actually turned out to be a very good issue. You mentioned the Green Grass Movement. It's this on the student boards. So there are students from nursing. There are students from medical students. Then suddenly there was a movement and the physiotherapists asked us, couldn't we change on this ward? What is the most remarkable thing on this ward? So students in their last year, medical students, nursing students, they treat patients, of course, under close supervisions, but they act as they are the doctor of this ward. And of course, the patients, there's an ethical vote on that. The patients have written their informed consent. And we have done research on that. And we have asked patients, the students, we have asked everybody who volunteered. Also, suddenly, students of molecular medicine said, oh, well, this is interesting. So I understand more about diseases. And our administrative people said, oh, you're doing something new. And so suddenly we had a think tank and we had a safe environment. And then we said, okay, medical students, they can just do great. And it was not only our feeling, we have the data on that. And the patient said, I want to go to this ward again. In nearly 97, 98% of cases, I just want to be admitted to this ward. People have time, people talk to me. So that was one thing, interprofessional communication. But you have to keep this, of course, alive. And then came the COVID pandemic. And, you know, all the hospitals shut down or reduced their work. Also, and then the student said, let's keep up this ward. And then I know we are on the right track. And we did not only keep up one ward. We established during the pandemic a second ward on the intensive care unit. And I'm very thankful to our med students who did such an amazing work during the pandemic. So these are our think tanks. Starting from this, we do have regular so-called strategic meetings because I'd like to know everybody what we are doing in our department, what our goals and aims are. We are in a university hospital, so we do strategic conferences on research, on our clinical work, on our teaching work. We have the stakeholders involved, work together with the administration. I think this is very important. Don't isolate yourself. Do meetings where everybody can speak up. So, and everybody can then see if she or he really can align his personal goals with the goals of our organization. And this really helped a lot.
So actually, it's creating an atmosphere where you belong, where you are heard, your ideas are heard, and if they can be, they are implemented. This creates a feeling of importance, right?
And a feeling of being informed all the time. You are informed. You can check at any time if your personal goals align with a strategic plan of our department. I found this very, very important. And then we have, of course, created targeted employee development programs designed to support staff at every level and discussing each person's needs and career paths. That was very important, and to open up career options for nursing students, academic career options for nursing students, encourage people to, you know, think beyond and go beyond their own profession. So that was, in our eyes, interprofessional work and communication, regular meetings on strategy, and also things, you know, like a mentoring and tutoring program from the start in our clinic. Then I have a lot of women like myself, female doctors, in a position where they return to work after having kids. So creation of flexibility actually in our practice environment that allows physicians to meet also their personal and professional obligations. That was also very important. It's not easy, I have to admit, because, you know, we are frontline workers. We're running not only an endoscopy, but also an intensive care unit. But I think there are always ways. Sometimes it's very good to be the boss.
Okay, Martina, we've seen it all. You're marvelous. Anything from data to actual implementation and a change in your own department. This is just mind-boggling. What have you done with this? But we could talk about this a long, long time. Still, we have to wrap things up. And I was wondering, do you have any advice for a GI in a dark and twisted place?
I would suggest you must reject the role of victim, always. Don't allow yourself one thought that classifies you as a victim. Never in your life, no matter how dark the place is, you are not the victim. You are the one who is the creator. And that's important. You reject the role of victim. And I personally like the psychologist Carl Rogers, who wrote, "The good life is a process, not a state of being. It is a direction, not a destination." Think of this. The good life is a process. And to make it a good life, you have to sustain a web of relationships that gives your life meaning and goodness. And especially in a dark place, you have to create relations outside of that, that help you decide if you love it, change it, or leave it. So sustain a web of relationships and bring out the best in people that you come in contact with. And I'm really, really convinced that this leads you into an upward instead of a downward spiral, because generosity is an upward spiral.
Oh, it brings tears to my eyes, but also to counterpoint your quotes and data, there's a really great, tragically comic book called This Will Hurt. And the quote is, "A great doctor must have a huge heart and distended aorta, through which pumps a vast lake of compassion and human kindness." So I guess wrapping up our talk is that first we have to be kind to ourselves and then to people around us and have a distended aorta.
Thank you so much. This is the best wrap up I ever heard and I enjoyed it so much. And thank you.
Thank you, Martina. It was amazing to have you here with all the data and actually all the solutions. This is very rare to have solutions to the problems. And thank you to all the listeners for being with us. We will see you in the next one. Ciao.